Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast. This is Tim Reedy. We're excited to have with us this week E.J. Dionne, the author of Our Divided Political Heart. He is a professor at Georgetown University and a columnist for the Washington Post. Welcome, E.J.
Good to be with you.
Congratulations on your new book, Our Divided Political Heart, which just came out last week, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent. Now, a lot of our readers know you as a commentator at NPR and a Catholic journalist, but this book shows that you're a real student of history. How did that interest develop for you?
Well, for me, it started when I was probably, in single digits. For some reason, I just loved American history. There were some great series of books for kids at the time, landmark books, We Were There books, signature books, and I just gobbled this stuff up. And then at my wonderful Benedictine High School, if I may say that to a Jesuit publication, I had some great history teachers. In fact, the dedication in the book is to my family, but also the first dedication is to all of my teachers, and two of my high school history teachers are in there. And so I've always loved the American story. And the funny thing is, while my view is very critical of the Tea Party's view, at the beginning of the book, I acknowledge the Tea Party and thank them for encouraging me to write this book. That was not their intention, obviously, because I thought they are quite right to say that we need to engage the American story from the beginning if we are to figure out who we are. And one of the reasons I argue in the book that we can't agree on who we are because we can't agree on who we've been. So I wanted to go back and say, here's who we have been. Here is what the founding was about. Here is how we dealt with government in the course of our history. I think we often turn to history at times of crisis. Certainly before the Civil War, Lincoln's most important speech that probably helped make him the Republican nominee in 1860 was his speech at Cooper Union in New York, where he went back and argued that the founders would have agreed with him on slavery, on the need for it eventually to die out. And so I think that if we're going to figure out who we are, we have to embrace history.
And you're looking back to history to kind of try to salvage one force in history that you think has been neglected. And that's what you're talking about here is our divided political heart. We've got the individualists, but also the kind of neglected communitarian. Maybe you could talk about that.
Right. I think this defines us all. I think all of us in some way are individualists, and all of us in some way are communitarians. And that tension, a healthy tension, I think, defines who we are as Americans. And of course, in every generation, we argue about the meaning of equality, the other core value. And that I think what's happened recently, but it's not just recently, and it's not just the Tea Party, we have laid such a heavy stress on our love of liberty and on a what I see as a radical kind of individualism that we forget that the American individualism was always a tempered individualism. I like to point out that the first word of our Constitution is the word we. It's not I. It's we the people of the United States. And the preamble of the Constitution lays out a series of collective goals that we know we need to achieve if we're to achieve a common good. The Declaration of Independence begins with a ringing affirmation of rights, our rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But the very last paragraph has our founders pledging their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to what in the end is a cooperative enterprise. And so I think we're at our best when we keep these two in balance. And I think we're at a moment when some of us, some Americans, are trying to argue that individualism is the sole defining value of what makes us Americans. And I just strongly dispute that.
Well, you're right that on one hand, the word community has better connotations than, for example, the collective. But on the other hand, you have somebody like Sarah Palin denigrating Obama's work as a community organizer. Why is community kind of more controversial than liberty?
Well, because a community, everyone thinks they know what they mean when they say liberty, whereas community can be referring to a national community or local community or neighborhood community. Community, as you suggested, does have that sort of collectivist ring The word communist even comes from the word community. And that, you know, I have in the book a series of examples where when the word community was applied to something, it often became controversial. Community policing, for example, which, by the way, has been very successful, sometimes got criticized from the right because it sounded like social work to them, and from the left because it sounded like it might give too much power to the police. Or the community action program under the Great Society was very controversial, and never mind that it actually helped lift up a whole generation of new leaders among poor Americans, particularly African Americans and Latinos. And so community is just a more complicated concept and a more vexed concept, whereas liberal or conservative, left or right, no American wants to be on the wrong side of the word liberty.
Well, you write in many ways about this tension. I thought one of the best ways you described it was we are in a country of both High Noon and It's a Wonderful Life. So that captures it very well.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, it's funny because there was while I was writing the book, I happened to sit down for breakfast one day with a very smart British conservative politician who had the same impulse. And I had always talked about It's a Wonderful Life, and he started talking about High Noon. And, It's a Wonderful Life, I should confess, is one of my favorite movies in the world. My wife got me a poster once, which hangs in our house. And I think George Bailey is actually a very good representative American, because on the one hand, he was a capitalist. He did own a bank. At the same time, he felt that his obligation to the community of Bedford Falls was in some ways the most important part of his work. So he was trying to succeed as an individual, but he saw his own success as an individual as being embedded in the success of that community and all of the people he helped become small property owners. And that, I think, that again, that balance between, you know, achievement and the common good is very much part of our story, which is why I think that movie continues to have a lot to teach us, which is why I'm glad it's on 16 different channels every Christmas time.
Well, one of the issues is, as you write, that rights in many ways, maybe it's just, you know, in the culture we live in, they're easier to talk about than duties. And the communitarian impulse implies a certain amount of duty to one another. So that seems to be part of the issue here.
Indeed. And, Obama's inaugural address was very interesting on this. And in the book, I say that there's a political critique to be made of Obama's inaugural address, that he might have politically used it better to describe how deep the mess, economic mess was that we were in, and what he intended to do about it. But the speech he actually did give was very challenging and I thought very interesting at the time and still, because he set his face against both, if you will, liberal kinds of individualism, a sort of 60s do your own thing kind of individualism, but also a kind of right-wing or conservative version saw capitalism and capitalist achievement as the only sort of way to organize our view of ourselves. And he challenged both sides of that. And, you know, there are times, and I say this in the book, in some ways, Obama may be more a communitarian than he is a liberal, which is why he might be so confounding to people.
Yeah, you say in many ways that shaped his success in a way that perhaps hasn't been fully explored yet.
And it's the way, for example, he talked about religion in that famous, or at least for those who follow these things, famous 2006 call to renewal speech. I think it was one of the best speeches, and I know a lot of conservatives who feel this way, by the way, one of the best speeches by a politician about religion's role. And again, he was very attentive to individual rights. He called out a certain style of religious conservatism that did not sort of accept us as the pluralist nation we are, insisted on the rights even of atheists. But at the same time, he called out those liberals who might not either appreciate the religious people who are involved in public life, and he told the whole story about how so many of our reform movements have been inspired by religious people, but were also so uncomfortable when religious people brought their voices to the public square, and he defended their role in the public square. And I think that attitude toward religion is very much the attitude of a communitarian. And I think at times some of those words of Obama, even though now he tends to be under assault from the right on these issues, there were moments when he made some people on the left feel uncomfortable with how religion-friendly he was, if you will. And again, I think that does come from a deep communitarian impulse. I think Catholics, by the way, are natural communitarians. I think that conservative Catholics are less individualistic in the way conservatives are individualistic, and liberal Catholics are less individualistic on sort of the lifestyle issues. I think it's at its best, I think the church does call us to a strong sense of community, and obviously the common good is essential to any Catholic approach to politics.
Sure, I'd certainly detected that kind of under the surface of your book is how, you know, I could read certain perhaps, you know, parallels with Catholic social teaching. And in some cases, they were explicit. For example, you mentioned Michael Gerson, the architect of compassionate conservatism, is a student of Catholic social teaching.
Right. Mike and I have been friends. And, you know, for people who read my column, know I was not on the Bush team during George W. Bush's presidency. but Mike is someone I've always admired because I think he is genuinely a compassionate conservative, and he has spent an enormous amount of time with Catholic social thought with papal encyclicals, and he really does believe in the common good. And inside the Bush administration, he was somebody who did push very hard for some of the concrete manifestations of compassionate conservatism, notably the PEPFAR program, the assistance to people in Africa on the AIDS question. And I talk about how conservatives like Mike are now kind of marginalized within the conservative movement. I write with what I hope conservatives, even though they will clearly disagree with me on a number of things, I hope they realize is a kind of respect, is a genuine respect, because I do really appreciate that conservative communitarian tradition. And I am sort of asking my conservative friends to rethink whether they want to throw it overboard, which is what I see them doing right now. I've been talking about the book. I'd like to remind people that one of William F. Buckley Jr.'s last books was called Gratitude. And it was a book about what people owe back to a society that nurtured them and protected them. And that is a brand of conservatism that we could use a lot more of.
Yes, I thought that while reading your book. What place would William Buckley or other Catholics who found a home at places like National Review, what place would they have in today's party with its kind of excessive emphasis on the radical individualism?
I am grateful that one of the blurbs on the book, which mostly come from people who are center-left, comes from Ramesh Panuru, who is a communitarian Catholic. And I was grateful he wrote that. And I think that, you know, if you look at National Review, I think a lot of National Review conservatives have moved with the movement toward this kind of individualism. And yet there are people there who have, and Ramesh is one of them, who have really held on to this communitarian tradition within conservatism.
Well, there's so much great history in this book. I want to pick up on a couple of themes. One is, as you write, these days we tend to accord a certain prophet status to the writers of the Constitution, but it seems very important to kind of demythologize these folks. Why is that important?
Well, it's important first because the facts of the matter are that they were human beings. They were politicians. They were just like us. They happened to be a particularly creative and farsighted bunch of human beings, but they were still human beings. And it actually, if I can use not a great word, disempowers future generations if we act as if this and only this generation was uniquely able to see certain truths. The second reason why that's important is because the Constitution reflects multiple values and also compromises. The founders compromised on one of the most important questions facing us, which is slavery. And they made a compromise which, in retrospect, we would say is not a compromise they should have made. The third way in which I think it's important to demythologize the founding is that because of those conflicting values that are inherent in the Constitution, and it's competing goods, I always think choices between good and good are much harder than choices between good and evil. Because of these competing values, we cannot assume that the founders provided us with guidance on every question we face now. I quote a great speech that retired Justice David Souter gave up at Harvard, where he talked about the difficulty of rendering decisions when you understood that there were competing values in the Constitution. And I argue that we should try to imitate the spirit of the founders who were very adventurous and not use the Constitution as a set of chains around us to prevent us from acting on our own behalf. And, you know, the last point I make on this is within 3 years of the Constitution's promulgation, James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, its two leading promoters and interpreters, were at each other's throats over whether the Constitution did or did not authorize the creation of a Bank of the United States. Now, if Hamilton and Madison could disagree 3 years after the Constitution was put out there, what does that make of originalism? How can we be so certain all the time that we know exactly what the original meaning of those words are?
Well, in some ways, the historical distance works against us because those folks, they knew the founders. They knew or at least, you know, it was within their common history. For now, it's a remove for us, so it's easier to kind of put these folks on a pedestal.
Well, I quote the legal scholar Garrett Epps, who noted that sometimes the originalists sound like they are saying, I knew the founders. The founders were friends of mine. I know what they'd think, they say 235 years later. But what you said is absolutely right. And Americans understood that in the politics for years after the Constitution, right through Lincoln, they were still arguing the meaning of the document. They understood when they were having constitutional arguments, they understood that some of these ideas were contested. You know, again, it was not a set of tablets handed from on high.
Now, part of your story centers on the Whigs, which is kind of a neglected story, at least for many people don't know it. But as you say, they may have been the most purely communitarian party in our country's history. Maybe you can talk about them.
Right. I when I finished the book, as you know, I argue about politics, not always arguing with my friend David Brooks on NPR every week. And I told him that the whole book was worth writing because I finally realized why David was crosswise to current American politics, which is he is the last surviving American Whig still among us. The Whigs, on the one hand, were very innovative in the ways in which they thought government could be used. They were strong advocates of public education. They were strong advocates for more humane treatment of the mentally insane. They saw an important role for the federal government in building the country. Henry Clay talked about the importance of internal improvements, which is a much nicer way to refer to infrastructure. I'd like to see advocates of infrastructure improvement use internal improvements instead. And so some people have said, well, that makes the Whigs precursors of modern liberals and progressives. But they were also quite conservative in their values. They were hierarchical. They were, for the most part, quite religious. They were referred to at the time as the Evangelical United Front at Prayer. And they often were Sabbatarians. They were often in favor of prohibition of alcohol. So they were this interesting mix. And looking back on them, modern-day liberals could embrace part of them. Some evangelical conservatives could also embrace aspects of Whiggery. But when I talk about in the book, I talk about Hamilton and Clay and Lincoln as people who showed us, if you simply look at what they did, it was obvious that government did not become an important force in our economy just when the populists and the progressives and FDR came along. Hamilton, Clay, and Lincoln all saw the federal government as playing a central role in the development of our economy and the creation, in Lincoln's case, of the land-grant colleges, which eventually became our great state universities. And so a pure anti-government view of America's origins leaves Hamilton, Clay, Lincoln, and a lot of other people out of the story.
Right. You write about that anti-government kind of sentiment and how, in many ways, it points to history, but it's really pointing to a relatively small slice of history, really the Gilded Age, but after Reconstruction and before, I guess, the rise of Teddy Roosevelt.
Right. And I think our friends in the Tea Party are taking the Gilded Age as representative of the entire thrust of American history. And so the way I look at the progressives and the populists, yes, they were innovative, and yes, they saw new things that government needed to do with the rise of capitalism and manufacturing and industrialization. But in fact, they were also, if you will, restorationists. I think they were restoring the longer tradition of balance between government and the market that went all the way back to the founding. And a lot of the court decisions that in some ways still vex us, including the decision that declared the corporation a person, were produced by an individualistic conservative Supreme Courts of that Gilded Age era. And I really see some of our friends on the right wanting to bring us back to both the jurisprudence and the politics of that era, which obviously, as anyone who's stuck with us this long knows, I think would be a terrible mistake.
Now, you're right that radical individualism, the problem we face today is that it is really enjoys almost complete control over the Republican Party. Is there anything the Catholic community specifically, and maybe the bishops as well, could do to counter this trend in that, you know, community is so important to the Catholic Catholic tradition?
Well, I've said for many years that I've always thought the Catholic Church's job is to make everybody feel guilty about something, which I guess proves I was raised and remain a Roman Catholic. Because I think that at its best, the Church calls out liberals and says to them, you must pay attention to life issues. You have to pay attention to the importance of the family, which, by the way, I do not believe needs to entail hostility to gays or lesbians, but the importance of the family to both economic fairness and a just society. And it calls out to conservatives to say, you may love the market, but you have to be concerned about the least among us. You have to be concerned about the common good in the market all by itself. Luxurious egoism, as Pope John Paul used to refer to it. The market all by itself doesn't create the kind of society we want. And I think if the Church is sort of making everyone feel a little bit guilty, or to put it in a different way, is calling out both sides for their moral shortcomings, then I think it's doing its job. I am very worried now that there's a tilt in the way the Church is operating, where it's calling out those of us on the liberal side a lot more than it's calling out our conservative friends on the other side. And I think that's a recipe in the long run for diminishing the Church's prophetic role. It should challenge us all.
Now, communitarian has been kind of central to your writings from the beginning. I think you mentioned that the National Review kind of cited this in the review of your first book.
It touched me at the time when the National Review actually gave a very kind review to Why Americans Hate Politics. Partly, it may be because I assigned William F. Buckley Jr. as important a role in American conservative history as Ronald Reagan, I think. But they were very, very kind to the book. And they didn't just call me a liberal. They called me a communitarian liberal. And I've always identified with that. My PhD thesis was about community inequality and how it related to racial politics in Britain and the United States. And, you know, I was much taken by the work of Richard Neuhaus and Peter Berger way back in the 70s when they did their they wrote a little pamphlet, really, or a short book called To Empower People, which talked about the role of mediating structures in American life. And, you know, some of it may come from growing up in a factory town called Fall River, Massachusetts, where, you know, community was just very much part of the way you understood yourself, even if you never thought about the word community at all. You know, where the churches and synagogues were important to social life, and neighborhoods were so important, and unions were so important, and it was a sort of way of life where you took community for granted. And as time went on, I was constantly fascinated by what happens when community is weakened or when community disappears. So I do not want to make it sound highfalutin, but it seems I had some calling to write this book because of that lifelong obsession with or engagement with the idea of and the reality of community.
I'll finish with a reference to a popular column you wrote recently on, you know, why I won't quit the Church. And it refers to an ad, I guess, that appeared in the New York Times and the Washington Post as well about some calling liberal Catholics to leave the Church. Is it because of that, you know, the communitarian impulse that's within the Church? Is that one of the things that kind of draws you back?
Well, that's certainly a very important part of it. And Catholic, the tradition of Catholic social teaching is such a gift to the world. But it also goes back to so much of what I think, the way I think, was shaped by the Church. I always like to note, for example, that I was just talking to some friends about this today, that first, the town I grew up in was almost all white. It was white working class. And the first real lesson I got in racial equality was from a nun who was teaching us up in New England with this wonderful Southern accent. I wondered why, what's she doing here with that Southern accent? And it turned out in the 50s she had organized a biracial integrated First Communion service for which she was sent north. And, you know, she was not a radical nun. She just thought that Jesus loved us all and that, for goodness sake, a First Communion service should be black and white together. And so much, you know, the monks who taught me at Portsmouth Abbey and the example of my parents, Catholicism is so central to, one way to put it is the parts of myself that I approve of, I guess. And, you know, that it would be, it's just very hard for me to divorce that from my feelings and identity as a Catholic. And I always joke with people that I became a liberal because I'm a Catholic. You know, I became a liberal because of what the church said about the poor and about our commitment to the poor. In high school, I for a Christian doctrine class, I read Martin Luther King's book of sermons. We had to write a paper, and I picked his book, Strength to Love. And again, he was obviously a Protestant, not a Catholic, but it was, again, the Christian message of reconciliation and the search for a beloved community. So I would just find it impossible to walk out of the church, and I feel great gratitude to the church. And at the moment, I have some differences with the direction some of the bishops want to take us, but I'd rather stay inside and make the case rather than go somewhere else.
Well, your book, again, is Our Divided Political Heart, and I think it's a great example of a Catholic intellectual engaging with the American intellectual tradition. So congratulations, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of the American Magazine podcast. We want to thank E.J. Dion for joining us and for you for listening. A reminder that you can subscribe to this podcast at iTunes or at americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.